Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. This really is a critical week in California's year-long battle with COVID-19. The number of new cases are setting records almost daily. Counties and regions of the state are headed back into lockdown mode, much like we experienced back in the spring. And Governor Gavin Newsom announced new technology to learn if you may have been exposed to somebody who has tested positive for the disease. The first doses of coronavirus vaccine could also arrive in the state as early as next week. Ahead on Insight this morning, we'll discuss contact tracing and California's surge in cases with a top COVID specialist at UC Davis Health. We'll also learn where the disease is spreading fastest in the state and why. And we'll get some of the do's and don'ts of going outside during new stay-at-home orders. But first, there's a lot going on politically surrounding the pandemic and in general. For one, we have a new presidential administration gearing up in Washington, and that is shaking up California's political structure quite a bit. Healthcare reporter at Politico, Alice Miranda Olstein, joins us now to get us up to speed with all of the movers and shakers. And welcome to Insight, Alice.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Let's start with California Attorney General Javier Becerra's pick to be incoming President Joe Biden's Health and Human Services Secretary. You say he was not Biden's first pick for the job. So what happened to the other candidates, including the governor of Rhode Island?
So we reported earlier this week and somewhat last week that there's been a real scramble on the HHS nomination, but Becerra is now the pick. Biden was all set to offer it to the governor of Rhode Island. She was not interested in leaving the state and coming to DC. And so he talked to some other candidates and it ended up being Becerra. That also, it fulfills things on a lot of levels. Progressives are excited about him because he's a past supporter of a lot of progressive policies, including Medicare for All. As well as, you know, contraception and abortion rights. And also, there's been a lot of pressure on Biden to make sure his cabinet is adequately diverse. And so there's been the Congressional Hispanic Caucus has been very active in talking to Biden's team about making sure that Latinos are adequately represented in the cabinet. So they're very excited about this pick.
Alice, how much conversation do you think went on between the Biden team and Governor Gavin Newsom when it came to picking Becerra? Because Becerra's pick does set into motion a whole lot of other political maneuvering here in California.
Absolutely. So we're not sure about those conversations specifically, but I think it is, it's been known for many months that Becerra was interested and was in contention for a role in the Biden cabinet. He was also talked about for attorney general as well as HHS secretary. And, you know, he's not necessarily an intuitive pick. There's already been criticism that he doesn't have a medical background himself, although many past HHS secretaries also don't have that. A lot of them have been governors or the heads of big universities. And a lot of the job is really managing a massive bureaucracy and really knowing the ins and outs of the law. And supporters say that he would bring that to the job.
Yeah, I was working in Wisconsin at the time that Governor Tommy Thompson was chosen as Health and Human Services Secretary. I remember thinking the same thing, like, that seems like a strange pick, but, you know, he's a governor. And like you said, it's managing a huge bureaucracy. I've already seen at least one U.S. Senator, Tom Cotton of Arkansas, really go after Becerra on several levels. I imagine he is helping to set the stage for the confirmation process.
Yes, absolutely. So a lot of Republicans have already come out saying that they are either opposed to Becerra or, you know, have tough questions for him when they are able to speak to him and when the confirmation hearings begin, which we don't know when that will be. So really, we're hearing two things. We are hearing about the lack of medical experience, but Becerra's defenders point out, you know, the last HHS secretary to have direct medical experience resigned in scandal. That was Tom Price. My colleagues exposed that he was taking private flights on the taxpayer's dime. And so that doesn't necessarily prepare one to be a good HHS secretary. In addition to the management piece of the job, it's really a communications job, too. It's convincing the country to, especially in the middle of a pandemic, to get on board with a lot of these policies and procedures needed to turn the turn the virus back and heal as a country. And so, you know, Becerra as a communicator also sort of brings that to the table. But also you're hearing a lot of Republicans and advocacy groups point to his long history of support for abortion rights and his litigation on that front on behalf of California.
Right.
And they are calling him an extremist, et cetera. I mean, his positions are very in line with where the Democratic Party is, but this is definitely going to be an issue going forward. Abortion, anti-abortion groups are already mobilizing to run ads about this, to pressure Congress not to confirm him because of this. And they're also going to use it in the Georgia runoff elections to try to say, this is the reason you should elect Republican senators and keep the majority out of Democratic hands, because if it's in Democratic hands, they'll confirm people like Becerra who support abortion rights. So this is going to have political ramifications for sure. And I think Becerra will have somewhat of a tougher confirmation process than some of Biden's other recent picks.
Is there someone that should Becerra not get the nod from the Senate? Is there someone that Biden could pick that wouldn't fall on that side of the pro-life, pro-choice battle?
So, like I said, his position on abortion rights is pretty much in line with where the Democratic Party is right now. I think what Republicans are able to point to and attack him on are specific cases that he's been part of. And potentially other people wouldn't have that on their resume and wouldn't be as easy to attack over this. But I don't necessarily think this will mean his confirmation is not going to happen. I just think it won't sail through as easily as some of these other picks.
Right. You write, now the man who challenged President Donald Trump's efforts to gut the Affordable Care Act, stop legal immigrants from using health programs, detain migrant children, and curb access to abortion is President-elect Joe Biden's pick to run the agency he antagonized. How much of what Becerra challenged as California's attorney general will he be able to reverse should he get confirmed as Health and Human Services Secretary?
So quite a bit, actually. And in addition to the pandemic, which is set to dominate at least the first 6 months of the new administration, if not more, a lot of his job will be looking at what can be rolled back from the Trump era. And I think that will, you know, take on a lot of fronts. Obviously, changes to the Affordable Care Act, a lot of that was done through executive orders and rulemaking, just dozens and dozens of them. Additionally, changes to Medicaid, such as the imposition of Medicaid work requirements or allowing states to impose Medicaid work requirements. I think there's going to be a real change on that front. And again, the detention of migrant children is something that falls under HHS's purview. It's even though it's an immigration issue, the Office of Refugee Resettlement is under HHS. And so we expect to see a lot of changes on that front, given Becerra's views on immigration.
Right. A lot more power in that office than or in that position, cabinet position, than people might. It's not one of the top cabinet positions that come to mind when you're thinking about the different top levels.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's what's known as the Big Four, which is Defense, Treasury, State, and the Justice Department. But really, there's talk now of the Big Six and adding HHS in the mix there as being especially important. And of course, because we're in a pandemic, it's going to be crucially important. Now, a lot of health policy is going to originate in the White House, and there's going to be a specific pandemic coordinator operating out of the White House. But still, the agency is responsible for making those ideas into reality, for implementing and figuring out how to do it. And so, like you said, it's going to be an enormously powerful position.
Yeah. Alice, do you see the pandemic consuming really the first 6 months of the new administration?
Oh, at least. I mean, just distributing the vaccine alone is going to be an enormous undertaking. And there's a lot of concern that states don't have the money or the preparations or the support from the federal government that they need. And so it's going to be very daunting for the Biden administration to come in January and to manage all of that. And especially because of the delay in certifying Biden as the winner of the election. You know, we had a 20-day wait. And so now they're playing catch up. They weren't able to talk to the federal workers who've been working on the vaccine this whole time. Now they can. Now they're having all those meetings. They're also meeting, you know, with governors and mayors and everyone up and down the spectrum who will have a hand in this. And, you know, there's both the logistics of making sure the vaccine gets out to all areas, but also there needs to be a messaging component of this. A lot of people are hesitant to take the vaccine, and it's going to take a lot of communication and education and combating misinformation to make sure that enough people get the shot so that as a population, we can defeat the virus.
If you subtract the pandemic from the entire equation, there's still a whole laundry list of healthcare challenges, right, that would await Becerra should he be in that position. Can you go down some of those for us?
Absolutely. So, I mean, a lot of it is sort of secondarily caused by the pandemic, but, you know, because tens of millions of people have lost their jobs, they've also lost their health insurance. And so expanding health insurance to be able to cover more people, that could take, that could happen on different levels. There's talk of how to encourage the states that still have not expanded Medicaid to do so. There's talk of making Obamacare's subsidies more generous so people can more easily afford them. There's talk of addressing surprise billing so that when you go to your doctor and you think it's in network and then you get a massive bill because some person there happened to be out of network and you didn't know, there's, you know, talk of how to address that. A lot of that would have to happen through Congress, but a lot of it wouldn't. It would happen through regulation. And so I think that, you know, he'll have a very full plate, not to mention all of the chronic health problems that we were dealing with before the pandemic. The opioid epidemic has gotten worse during the pandemic. That is a huge thing to tackle. Vaping and smoking, of course, and just, you know, the general health disparities where low-income people, you know, don't have as good access to as good or any access to medical care and have poor underlying health. So just really a lot of challenges on that front. And we've had some, you know, all our attention has been focused on the pandemic, but the pandemic has also shone a light on some of these issues that we will have to address at one point or another.
Allison, about a minute, do you expect to see any other high profile positions filled by California politicians, and any sense of who might get the nod to replace Vice President-elect Kamala Harris's Senate seat?
So for the Senate seat, we have heard the chatter around Secretary of State Padilla, for sure. And I mean, Becerra was discussed for that as well before this announcement. And so, you know, basically every announcement that Biden makes, it sort of narrows down the pool for the remaining jobs. And, you know, we sort of update our calculus. But that could be very interesting. And also, you know, I think that there's pressure on Biden to have racial diversity in his cabinet and gender diversity. I think there is also pressure to have geographic diversity. And so I would imagine that having too many Californians, you know, I am a Californian. I think it's great. There should be a lot of us, you know, in prominent positions, but I do understand that he wants to, you know, draw people from different parts of the country so everybody does feel represented.
Right. Healthcare reporter at Politico, Alice Miranda Olstein. Alice, thank you so much. Really great information this morning.
Thank you.
Up next, the importance of contact tracing and how the new California Notify app can help the state curb the spread of COVID-19. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. Stick with us, a lot still ahead. I'm Randall White.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. Contact tracing. It's something we hear about all over the news as one of the many things done when someone tests positive for COVID-19. But how does it really work? In California, Governor Newsom has been stressing the importance of contact tracing since the pandemic started. By October, the state had nearly 11,000 contact tracers, all working toward mitigating the spread of COVID-19. The procedure again took center stage yesterday as Newsom announced a new app being rolled out called California Notify. It's an opt-in service, meaning that no one is automatically enrolled. Google and Apple, two California companies and two fierce competitors, actually joined forces to help create this software, according to the governor. Here he is talking about it yesterday.
Fully automated, opt-in technology, not contact tracing, does not in any way, shape, or form provide any of your personal information in any part of the process and protocol. And this is a pilot that now we're bringing to the state as a statewide opportunity that we've been engaged in since September. Specifically, the pilot began with the UCs, and we officially started with California. Well, the University of San Francisco, and then expanded to more California UC campuses.
Yeah, and UC Davis is now part of that collaboration, here to help us better understand contact tracing and the California Notify app is Dr. Brad Pollack, Associate Dean of Public Health Sciences at the UC Davis School of Medicine. Welcome back to Insight. It's always nice to speak with you, Doctor.
Thanks, Randall. Nice to be back, especially on the last day of the fun drive.
Right? So let's start with this new technology that's rolling out on Thursday. I did hear the governor in there say this is not contact tracing. So what is it and what is UC Davis's role in the development?
Yeah, well, the governor is spot on. It is not contact tracing. It is an additional arrow in the quiver of getting to the point of trying to control the epidemic. The technology is actually not very complicated. It's pretty simple. This new California Notify app actually is something that has been baked into the newest version of the Apple iOS operating system for your iPhone. So you don't have to install anything. You just have to have your updated operating system and you turn it on. For Android, there is a app you have to download. So it's pretty straightforward. But what this is a system that looks at proximity using Bluetooth to other iPhones, essentially, or other Android devices, other smartphones. And it basically keeps track of who you've been in contact with through random numbers that identify a unique phone. And the way it works then is it keeps that log. If somebody then reports that they were positive, it sends a signal out to those users who would have qualified as having what we call high contact, being in contact with somebody, physical contact, you know, within 6 feet for 15 minutes or more. And that's even cumulative over multiple sessions. It keeps track of that. And it then notifies the user that, aha, you have been in close proximity to somebody who tested positive. So there, as the governor said, there's no information that is sent anywhere on that basis. It's not uploaded to a web server. Nobody's keeping track of it. It's literally for you as a user to know that you've come in contact with somebody who, you know, physical contact with somebody who did test positive.
But if I was in a line behind somebody at the grocery store for 5 minutes and then that person tests positive, I would not be contacted just because the length of exposure wasn't long enough to trigger that result?
That's right. We're looking at high contact exposures, and they're defined. The CDC has defined those, not casual. And again, I'm not exactly clear what thresholds from an engineering standpoint, because people move in and out. It'll take an average distance, you know. So if you get within a foot of somebody, that may be weighted more heavily than staying 5 feet 11 inches away. So that, you know, that it has a little bit of intelligence built in like that. But the idea here is to increase the number of people who know that they might have been exposed. And that is really additional to the traditional contact tracing we do. When somebody gets a positive test result, then we use the old shoe leather epidemiology to investigate that. And we ask about contacts. That's a very important part of this. It uses a completely different software system to manage it for the state. It uses the CalConnect system. So this is an adjunct to what we're already doing.
Mm-hmm. What was UC Davis's role in testing this new software?
Yeah, well, let me just say it started with UC San Diego. My close colleagues down there really kind of had launched the pilot, and they're kind of coordinating it. And UC San Francisco joined next. And the two of them did the very, very initial pilot. And then we were in the next tier. I think there were five additional UC campuses that volunteered. I will say that UC Davis was the first campus to actually involve the community. As you're probably aware, we have our Healthy Davis Together project going on in Davis, which is the whole community. And so we rolled it out on a community basis there, whereas the others were really confined to the UC campus employees and students. So we did contribute that for a couple of weeks, and now it was successful enough. So the governor decided, and the Department of California Department of Public Health, to go ahead and open it up statewide, which is great. And we're a little bit behind the eight ball. The other states like Arizona had opened it before we did. They have a whole statewide system. But what's really cool, as you said, is Apple and Google got together to create the framework for this exposures notification way of doing things. And that's really kind of unprecedented.
Yeah, you don't hear that very often, if ever. So you mentioned Cal Connect. Talk a little bit about that. That was developed by Accenture and Salesforce.
That's correct. That was a tool for the state health, public health department and the local health authorities, the county departments, to manage their contact tracing efforts. So when a case was reported from a testing lab as being positive, that would trigger then a new record in the Cal Connect system. And that was the software platform by which folks did their case finding and looked at potential contacts. So that was a management system there. And I have to say the state, the California Department of Public Health has been great. They've even added some extensions to that system to do a virtual portal for schools to report. Even before you had an official diagnostic confirmed case, there were ways of entering in data that they facilitated to allow some early preliminary or presumptive case input into that system. So that was something that they did. They went out of their way. They worked with the colleges and universities in the state to add that capacity. But that's a separate software system, works quite well. This is entirely different. This is, again, a proximity Bluetooth-based system for figuring out whether you've been in close proximity to somebody.
Doctor, with more than 20,000 new positive tests being revealed every single day in the state, you can't contact trace all of those people. At what point does somebody rise to the level that they need to undergo contact tracing?
Yeah, that's a great question, Randall. We do want to try to contact trace everybody. I mean, that's the goal. If you recall back 4 or 5 months ago, when we had some of the labs returning results 7 or 8 days later, public health authorities like the county health departments decided they were not going to go ahead and they didn't have the personnel to do contact tracing for people that were diagnosed 8 days ago because it's too late. So, you know, what's happened is we've actually compressed the time period between when people get tested and they get the results back. So now those fresher cases are the ones that really are going to be the most useful to contact trace. So we're doing more of that. We've added capacity in different places. I know UC Davis has added 12 new contact tracers to help Yolo County out. So we are trying to build that capacity up. We're trying to make it more smooth because it really is important to do that. With the exposures notifications approach here, one of the things that's really key is it only works well when you have people that have turned on the system, right? So the more people that participate, the better this tool is at trying to help identify new exposures that you wouldn't have otherwise. But I would say that our contact tracing efforts really are meant to be complete as much as possible to be able to quickly identify potential cases out there and contacts and get them isolated or quarantined to reduce transmission. This is, another wonderful tool that we think will be great if people turn it on. There is an issue, though, with disparities here. And if you think about it, you know, there's a disparity here with using a tech solution like this that's related to age. I can tell you a lot of 80-year-olds don't know my mother doesn't know how to use her iPhone. I mean, she won't know how to turn this thing on. It's not hard to do. But if you look at that, there's certainly an age disparity. And there may be disparities here, of course, based on some of the traditional underserved populations that we have here. Not everybody has a smartphone, for example. And that may sort of correlate with race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status. So we do have that issue that a high-tech solution like this may not be, you know, a perfect solution. But it's, like I said, another arrow in the quiver.
Doctor, briefly, I spoke with you back in the spring a couple of different times. You've really been at the forefront of this whole COVID pandemic. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on where California is right now with COVID-19.
Yeah, good, great question. Well, we're in a crisis. We're in our surge right now, and it's very concerning. We're going to see drastic measures. We're going to see, I think, the greater Sacramento area will be moving into that stay-at-home order. that now has hit other regions of California. The numbers are going up, hospitalizations are going up. That's concerning. We need to get a handle on reducing transmission. So that's concerning. You know, the thing is with this surge right now, and we're going to see more cases, I'm sure, over the next 2-3 weeks from Thanksgiving. It's just such an irony that it's in the face of a vaccine being distributed probably in 2 weeks. And it's just one of those things you want to have people hold on, just be very careful right now, because we're not talking about a solution a year from now. We're talking about months away to have vaccination, which will really have a very big impact. I'll just share with the listeners also that a lot of us know that the vaccine is very important. It will be the thing that gets us out of the pandemic. But if we don't combine that with the normal public health prevention measures here, we're going to have a lot more deaths on our hands. So all these things we're doing with masking, because we're not going to have full vaccination for 6 months to a year. So all of these public health measures to reduce transmission are so important, even when we get vaccinations going. But I can tell you, having healthcare workers vaccinated, my colleagues, you know, they're out sick themselves or they're being quarantined. They're not able to provide health services to patients. We're rescheduling elective surgeries across the state right now. Not all of them, but that's an issue. So I think getting the vaccination moving quickly is going to be important. But again, people have to really kind of bear down. And unfortunately, some of these draconian measures really are probably going to be the things that keep the transmission from really growing a lot.
And doctor, I think it's just a human nature thing with the vaccine. You know, you think to yourself, I wasn't really hungry until the food was put down on the table, or I really didn't have to go to the bathroom until I started standing in line for it. You know, so I think, you know, we've been told about this vaccine. We just want to get back to normal as quickly as we can. And so it triggers that response in our brain that we want to speed things up. So we have to be patient and right now be better than ever. Right.
Absolutely.
So. Dr. Brad Pollack, he's the Associate Dean for Public Health Sciences at the UC Davis School of Medicine. We always appreciate having you on Insight. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Randall.
You've heard many times on this program that communities of color have been disproportionately affected by COVID-19. In California, Latinos have absolutely been hardest hit, according to data from the California Department of Public Health. California is about 39% Latino, but that population makes up nearly 58% of COVID-19 cases and tragically 48% of the state's deaths from the pandemic. Contact tracing could be harder to do when someone who is Latino and doesn't speak English is being called. Joining us now is Dr. Jeffrey Reynoso. He's the executive director of the Latino Coalition for a Healthy California. That's a policy organization advocating for health equity of the Latino community. Dr. Reynoso, welcome to Insight. Nice to have you here.
Good morning and thanks for having me.
So the number of Latinos affected by COVID-19 is really striking. And we know that Latinos are often frontline and essential workers, but is there something more to what's behind this population being so disproportionately affected by the virus?
I think it's important to recognize that the COVID-19 virus has really penetrated our existing systems that were perpetuating inequality in our society prior to the pandemic. As a result, Black and Brown communities have been hardest hit. For Latinos in particular in the Latino community, we're more likely to work in essential occupations. So farm workers, meatpacking workers, domestic workers, restaurant workers, all these occupations that are making it possible for all of us to continue living productively during this pandemic. And so without the ability to work from home, Latinos are more likely to be exposed in their workplaces. There's also this issue of multi-generational households, right? Latinos are more likely to live with their grandparents, with their abuelitos and their abuelitas, and the virus can more quickly penetrate and transmit within a household. And finally, I'll just mention, there's a good reason to delay healthcare. Latinos prior to the pandemic were more likely to be uninsured, have less access to healthcare. And within this current pandemic, we're seeing testing deserts in communities of color and delay of care when those individuals that have those higher risk symptoms are delaying care. And that's also exacerbating some of the inequality that we're seeing in the community.
Yeah. And tragically, because of the high number of deaths that we mentioned, there's been more funerals in that community too, which bring people together.
Absolutely. It's been, you know, I think you mentioned up at the top, it's been just really devastating the Latino community. This is like many other communities, we are very family oriented, and not being able to see a loved one, not being able to see a loved one in the hospital or attend a funeral is really, really tragic, and having long-term generational effects in terms of trauma. And so that's another another factor that I think we're experiencing with this current pandemic. The post-COVID trauma is very real and is likely something that health systems are going to have to deal with post-pandemic.
Yeah. Doctor, in about a minute, can you talk about some of the barriers for COVID-19 contact tracing in Latino communities?
Yeah. So one of the things that we're seeing in particular with contact tracing is really the lack of linguistically and culturally competent workforce. I think it's been said, I'm sure many times before, that in order to effectively reach the community, the data show if you want to reach quality healthcare outcomes, you really need providers that understand your not only your language, but your culture. And here in California, with both the state's contact tracing program, the county-based programs, they're really, really challenged to really staff up and try to find those culturally and linguistically competent contact tracers that can really have these really hard conversations around and share really sensitive information as it relates to their contacts, you know, prior to a positive COVID diagnosis. I'll also share with the Latino community in particular, it's a very diverse community, racially, linguistically. So oftentimes, we think of Spanish, right, as the language of as our primary language, but we also have a sizable indigenous communities here in right. California. And particularly when you look at the Central Coast region, farm working communities oftentimes speak other indigenous languages like Mixteco. And so again, that's kind of an added barrier on finding that workforce that can adequately contact trace in the middle of a pandemic.
Yeah. Dr. Jeffrey Reynoso is Executive Director of the Latino Coalition for a Healthy California. Thank you for the insight into a really large portion of California's population that is disproportionately affected by this pandemic. And still ahead, regions of California are headed into or already in stricter stay-at-home orders. So we tap the expertise of CAP Radio's environment reporter, Ezra David Romero, to find out what you can and cannot do if you're looking to enjoy the great outdoors. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we are back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we are on the cusp of another lockdown with slightly fewer restrictions than we saw back in March, but there's still confusion as to what is and isn't allowed. And depending on where you're listening right now, you might already be in a lockdown. Outdoor activities are encouraged. If you take daily walks, runs, or hikes, you're not expected to change your routine all that much. And here to help us figure out how to stay safe while enjoying some sunshine and fresh air is CAP Radio's environment reporter, Ezra David Romero. Ezra, it's always a pleasure to see you.
Thanks, Randall.
Yeah, so let's start with the basics. We are still allowed to go for a walk or a bike ride around the neighborhood, but there's a catch.
Yeah, when a community crosses that threshold of 15% capacity for those ICU parts of the hospital, people are asked to stay in their neighborhoods, you know, but they have to wear a mask at all times, keep a distance of 6 feet away from each other. And the caveat is to stay with only people from your households.
Mm-hmm. And so when you go out, let's say you hit up the park and you want to walk around the park a few times, you have to have a mask on?
Yeah, wear a mask, normally they were saying in the past you could walk with a friend, you know, socially distance with a friend. But this time they're saying, don't even go with a friend, like only go with someone who lives with you in your house. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so stay away from everyone else.
Yeah, sticking with the park scenario, kids can still use the equipment?
They can if it's open, but a lot of places, including the city of Sacramento, Sacramento County, they're closing down playground equipment. So people can go to park as long as they're socially distanced. There's a little bit of an argument over playgrounds. Some people think they should remain open, but since there are these like high touch areas where people congregate, you know, places like the city of Sacramento say they will close them once the threshold is hit. Mario Lara, he's the director of youth parks and community enrichment for the city of Sacramento. I talked to him yesterday. Here's what he had to say.
When we reach that threshold, it appears that playgrounds is an area where we will have to post signage indicating that the public health order has been updated to say that the public should stay away from those areas. I think that's in an effort to avoid gathering. So one of the things that we think happens under the new guidance is there should be no gathering with people outside of your household. So while the open spaces are available, people should avoid, you know, watch that distance, stay 6 feet away from each other. And make sure that they're not in groups.
Yeah, Mario says he will take his count. He will take his cue from the county, but the county says they're going to take their cue from the state, which are putting these broader restrictions out. I talked to Ken Kasparis. He's the public information officer for Sacramento County about this, and they haven't implemented rules yet, but they will soon if we get to that point. Here he is.
It's a safe way to get some sunshine, even if it's a little chilly out. Our trails are open, our parks are open. And if you do choose to go enjoy our facilities, just please practice social distancing. Wear a mask if you're going to be in a populated area and you worry that you might not be able to maintain that 6 feet of distance between you and someone else.
I was at Curtis Park just yesterday in Sacramento, and I saw some people having a picnic, and they seemed to be really safe about it. They were sitting pretty far apart from each other. What are the guidelines on having a picnic at the park?
Well, you can have a picnic as long as you're with people from your own household. That's happens once that capacity hits. So if you go out there with, say, someone in your own household, a family member, your dogs, you know, that's all fine. But once you bring your friends out, or even if you're 6 feet away under this guideline, it's a no-no.
How do you know if your county has hit that threshold? Like right now, currently in Sacramento County, we are or are not at that threshold?
From what I understand, we're not at it. We're close to it, something like 17 or 18%. But once it reaches that 15% is when that goes into effect. And then the county and the state work together to put that order out. So there's a website, there's a COVID tracker website that goes through all that. The counties and cities are putting press releases and announcing information like that. And then places like CAP Radio, you know, deliver that message out to the public.
Right. Yep. So you said we have to stay local. I remember this was a big deal back in the spring. How local do we have to stay?
Well, last time there was this big discussion about whether we can go from county to county, right? Like, cause you know, if you live in Sacramento, like I do, close to downtown, you know, the next county is just over across the river. So it's this hard dynamic to be part of. But this time they're growing even more granular. They're saying, don't leave your neighborhood. Like local doesn't mean me leaving Sacramento and going to Auburn or to Poly Pines for a hike. Local means staying in your neighborhood as much as you can. So exploring the parks in your community, going on walks in your community, staying at home, because once again, remember, the goal is to stop this upward trend of the virus spreading. So skirting around the order sort of defeats that point. And when you go on a trip, even like an hour away, the probability that of you stopping is high, whether you have to use the restroom, you know, you want to buy some food, maybe you run out of gas. So there's opportunities for congregating and encountering other people. And that's what they want to stop.
Mm-hmm. Back in the spring, you'll recall they were shutting down parking lots at beaches and shutting off certain trails and that sort of thing. Do you foresee that happening this time around?
Some of that still is in place. Some of that reduced parking and is still in place, and one-way trails and things like that on public in public parks and beaches. I mean, it could go there again if this trend doesn't reverse. You know, mm-hmm. if people don't take this seriously and people still congregate, and then there are these quote-unquote super spreader events or maybe even happening at these parks or places, I can see if things like that happen, maybe the restrictions could even be even more severe.
Yeah, not all of us are, you know, lucky enough to live next to a really dynamic park or some sort of outdoor area. So what are some activities for those people?
Yeah, in Sacramento, there's something like 202 parks in the city limits, and almost every Sacramentan lives within half a mile of a park. There are some exceptions, but there is some kind of green space for almost everyone here. But Rachel Norton, she's the executive director of the California States Park Federation, says they have a whole list of things you can do outdoors and how you can bring the outdoors home, including virtual tours of natural parks. That link is on our website in my latest story about the topic. And let's hear what she has to say about how to get outdoors and maybe not be bored.
Not everybody has walking or bike access to a local park. And that's where the bring the outdoors home ideas come in. Lots of ideas about things you can do with your kids in the neighborhood, looking for birds or, you know, looking at leaves and trying to identify trees.
Again, Rachel Norton there, executive director of the California State Parks Association.
Foundation.
Sorry. That's okay. Cap Radio's environment reporter, Ezra David Romero. Always great information, Ezra. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And that is Insight for today. I'm Randall White with producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon. Digital team, shout out to them, Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minotta. Insight's managing editor is Aram Sarkissian. We will be back tomorrow with a brand new show talking about water in California. I'm Randall White. Have a great day.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.